Ron, I have some bad news to report.
What's that?
I just found out that WikiLeaks has copies of every unedited podcast we've ever done going back to 2006, and they're going to release it on the internet. Ron?
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm posthumously Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Ken, let's just assume that Julian Assange has better things to do with his time than to mess with any of our previous tapes.
We would be so... Look, it's under, I understand that the United States government is embarrassed about some of the private conversations we've had with our diplomats, shall we say, regarding Pakistan, Russia, Yemen.
Iran.
Afghanistan.
China.
Afghanistan, Albania, Algeria, Argentina,
Japan,
Australia, Austria, Belgium, Bolivia, Brazil.
Korea, and some other countries.
Yes, but the podcast going up unedited.
This would be a violation of the First Amendment.
Well, it would end our employment.
Sure. But seriously, Ken, what about that debt commission?
Well, you know something, this is Profiles in Courage Week in Washington, because on Friday there's going to be a vote on the debt commission. There are 18 members. You need 14 members voting aye in favor of these draconian cuts.
And severe cuts. And tax increases.
Tax increases.
Trillions of dollars.
Yes, and it's one thing for Alan Simpson, who's been out of office a long time, and Erskine Bowles, who failed in his two bids for public office, to propose this. But it's another thing for members of Congress who serve on this commission to say, wait a second, I'm not going for any of this stuff.
12 members of Congress, current members of Congress, are among the 18. And right now, as best I can tell, well, we're about 24 hours before the vote right now as we're recording, but it looks like maybe two of the elected members are on board for sure.
Right,
and the other 10, we don't know yet, but several of them have said they really don't think so. It looks unlikely they're going to get very many of those 12, but it's possible they'll get at least a majority of the 18. They could get 10.
Right, but they need 14.
But that's, they need 14 to advance the plan to a vote in Congress.
And the two who have already signed off on it are Judd Gregg, who is not only the ranking Republican on the Budget Committee.
But also retiring.
Retiring, exactly.
Clean, important,
but
retiring.
Interesting, Ken Conrad, who was the Senate Budget Committee chairman, a Democrat from North Dakota, is up for re-election in 2012.
Is up for re-election, but we may have just heard an announcement here when he said he was going to vote for the debt and deficit commission.
He may be joining Byron Dorgan.
He may be joining his colleague, Byron Dorgan, from the great state of North Dakota in retiring.
Yeah.
Because then he doesn't have to worry about it. And he has always been a deficit hawk. And he and Judd Gregg have jumped off many a cliff together over the years, running the Senate Budget Committee together. But we still have four other senators who haven't declared, including Dick Durbin, who's the number two Democrat in the Senate. And we just don't know which way they're going. But it does not seem likely that they're going to take a big chance with their own political standing, because we don't expect any of these others to retire.
And then basically we're back to where we always were, and there's no profile in courage. No.
Oh, you were being a little ironic when you said it was profiles in courage.
Well, I was, in the sense that, I mean, look, you do have re-elections to worry about, but, I mean, every time we say that we have to make these great sacrifices, either in spending cuts or tax increases, Republicans won't go for one and the Democrats won't go for other, and yet we're back to where we started.
And speaking of profiles in courage, the other big issue, of course, that is before Washington this week is what to do with the expiring tax cuts from the early Bush years, 2001, 2003. These are substantial tax cuts that made a big impact on the budget and got rid of the threat of a surplus that had been lingering there in the year 2000.
Well, one of the reasons why the surplus was.
Well,
right.
That's right. Then along came the wars that were not paid for, and the Medicare Part D prescription drug benefit that was not paid for. And then, of course, the enormous fall off in revenues with the financial collapse and the cost of TARP and the cost of some of these other bailouts. Even though some of that money is being recovered, we have built up suddenly the biggest annual deficits that the federal government has ever run. So there were lots of contributing factors. But the first ones, and really, when you think about the long term, the most potent of these, because they just keep getting bigger in their budget impact, are these tax cuts. And it appears that at this point, we are going to at least temporarily extend them for all levels of income.
Well, the Democrats laid down a marker early in this saying that, yes, we'll renew the middle-class tax cuts, but those earning over $250,000 a year, forget about it. But
only for the income over $250,000. In other words, for all income under $250,000,
right,
the tax cuts would be extended,
right,
maybe even made permanent. which is the first vote the
this
House
has taken.
This is
the Democratic argument, but not those earning over $250,000 a year.
No, only that income over $250,000. Yeah. And this is, I think, where the Democrats lost control of this argument, because the Republicans are able to say, we want a tax cut for everyone, or we want to not have a tax increase.
Especially
for
in a
anyone.
Recession, nobody wants to raise taxes. And basically, by if we don't extend these tax cuts, we're in effect causing a tax increase.
That's,
in all these
that's
people.
Right, and that's a valid argument. Right. It's a misnomer, really, to talk about tax cuts at this point, because we've had these tax rates for
they
the better part
exist.
Of a decade, and the effect of letting them expire would be for people to suddenly find themselves paying more taxes on January 1st, their first payroll check in January. Everyone would feel it. Now, the other misnomer, though, is talking about no tax cut for the higher income people, because they would get a tax cut just like everybody else up to the $250,000 level for joint filers. Right. It's the income after that that would not get a tax cut.
Right now, Charles Schumer, the Democrat from New York, Senator from New York, also talked about this, changing it to income beyond $1 million. This is one of the Democrats' way of
Wouldn't that
to
seem obvious? I mean, I don't know. I don't understand why they've lost control of this argument
they
so
have.
Badly, which they clearly have. And the Republicans are just on cruise control here, saying no tax increase on anybody.
Well,
and that sounds great, whereas the Democratic argument gets very convoluted and complicated, and you start talking about all these income-level questions and who's middle class and who's not. And, I think the average taxpayer is justified in saying, well, I just don't want a tax increase, so I guess I'm with the guys who say no tax increase on anyone.
And to show that this is a winning political argument, the Republicans are saying that nothing is going to get done in Congress, not the repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, not the extending of the unemployment insurance.
Dream Act.
The Dream Act, right.
So children of immigrants.
Just shows that the Republicans have won this argument, at least in this lame duck session.
That's right. They're saying essentially, we get our way on the tax cut issue, or no deal on anything else. And they are also putting one other thing in there, which is they want a long-term extension of the spending authority, which is to say, keep the government running. Don't shut the government down.
Don't do what we did in 1995 when Clinton and Gingrich basically shut down the government to the Republicans' peril. I mean, Clinton won that argument back in 95.
And back at that time, the Republicans wanted, they were pushing the idea of a temporary shutdown of the government because they thought that would help them make their point. It didn't, and so they're afraid of that now. We'll come around to talking about this again when we get to the debt ceiling.
Can I just say one thing, though? I also think that Bill Clinton is far more astute politically than Barack Obama is in this. There was a very good piece by Ari Shapiro on NPR this week that talked about that President Obama, in many ways, is not even negotiating. He's throwing out concessions without getting anything in return. And so you just wonder if the White House is really up to the task of playing politics the way Clinton was so effective.
Well, and the other thing is, when Bill Clinton was going toe-to-toe with the Republican Congress in 95 and 96, it was a clearly Republican Congress.
Right.
It was Republican House, Republican Senate. His eventual opponent in 1996 for the presidency, Bob Dole, was running the Senate. And Newt Gingrich was a household name. The whole country knew who Newt Gingrich was. And the fortunes of the House Republicans rose and fell with Newt Gingrich.
Right.
So he had real advantages there over the Obama situation.
He, Bill Clinton, yes.
That's right. Bill Clinton had real advantages over Obama's situation. He has a divided Congress where the Democrats are still nominally, supposedly, in charge of the Senate next year. But I think the government is going to be largely run by the Republican Party next year, but it will still look like the Democrats' government, and they will still get the blame for all the slow recovery problems, all the high unemployment. This is a very difficult situation for them.
It is. I mean, obviously, it would probably be in the Democrats' best interest to let people know who John Boehner is, just the way that Republicans let people know who Nancy Pelosi was. But the Democrats, who so effectively demonized Dole and Gingrich in the Republican Congress in the 1990s, they've got to do something. Otherwise, you're absolutely right. People will say that even though the Republicans may be running things, the Democrats will get the blame in 2012. And that's what Mitch McConnell has said. Our goal is to finally take over the government in 2012 with the Senate, with beating Obama for the presidency. So right now you can make the argument that the Democrats are still in charge.
I think the one false move they've made in these last weeks and months of their success, the Republicans on the congressional side, was Mitch McConnell's statement that you just referred to about our number one priority is the defeat of Barack Obama. That is exactly the kind of naked partisanship that voters say they object to. On the other hand, that is the mood of his own party. And so he was clearly speaking to his own base voters and saying, I'm your guy. You don't need Jim DeMint running the Senate in my place.
This was a very strange week regarding that kind of outward and overt partisanship, because when it started, when President Obama met with the congressional Republicans for the first time since the November 2nd elections, they was talking about, you know, progress and understanding and all things like
exchange of views,
and both sides seemed pretty happy about it. And then a day later, you know, you hear McConnell saying that nothing gets done until the tax cuts or issue is resolved.
42 of them all signed a letter saying we won't allow any of this other legislation, however desirable it might be on its own merits, to go forward until we've resolved the tax issue and until we've resolved the issue of continued funding of the government, which is to say the appropriations process broke down last year. None of the appropriations bills was approved in the Senate. They have been surviving, that is to say, keeping the federal government running on continuing resolutions, which just continue the authority to spend according to the last approved appropriations bill over a year ago. And this is kind of inside baseball and it's kind of mechanical stuff. But without it, that's when you get a government shutdown.
Right. Assuming that the tax issue is resolved, what else gets accomplished? The Don't Ask, Don't Tell is on the agenda. What happens with that?
Well, Don't Ask, Don't Tell is the subject of a very interesting couple of days of hearings towards the end of this week. And the top leadership of the Pentagon, both uniformed and civilian, have gotten behind this report that says...
Released by the Pentagon.
Done by the Pentagon. It's gone on for many months. It's a very extensive report of attitudes in the military that says that 70% of the active military personnel feel that it would be a good thing if Don't Ask, Don't Tell were repealed, or that it would be kind of a mixed bag of good things and bad things, or that it would not really make much difference at all.
Right.
Now, I mean, when you put all that together, it doesn't really add up to very active resistance to the acceptance of openly homosexual members of the services.
And, you know, what I thought was fascinating is that throughout this year, when there was pressure on Congress to vote on this, John McCain, whose views are very widely anticipated and followed, he said, I'm not going to do anything on Don't Ask, Don't Tell until we hear from the Pentagon. Now we have heard from the Pentagon, and yet he still says, well, I still don't feel that morale won't be negatively affected.
And the argument has changed now. The conservatives' argument has shifted in just recent days since this report came out. They're trying to pick the report apart to some degree and say, well, what about the methodology? Was this really done in a scientific way, or were, you know, was the deck stacked in some sense or another?
Were they cell phone? Done on cell phones.
The other argument is that the main source of resistance is coming from the Marine Corps and from other combat-oriented units, the trigger pullers, the people who really have to go out, take the fire, suffer the casualties, and that that's where the resistance to allowing the openly gay to serve in the military comes from. And that argument essentially says, well, you know, sure, fine, the larger military with all the supply and et cetera, maybe those people don't have an objection. But if our brave troops who are actually on the front line object, then we object. So that's the fallback position.
Even though John McCain seems to be adamant about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, he seems certainly more receptive about passing and having hearings on and voting for the new START treaty with Russia. Both McCain and retiring Senator George Voinovich are among the two Republicans who this week said, well, you know something, once we get what we want on other issues, mm-hmm. we could very well start the START vote. And, you know, we talked about John Kyle torpedoing it, but actually it looks like we will have that START vote and a passage of it, needing 67 votes, mind you.
All right. Well, we've got 58 Democrats left in the Senate now with the moving on of Roland Burris. And
oh,
swearing.
No. What happened?
Well, he was not elected.
oh, that's right.
The time that he was there to serve out the end of Barack Obama's term in the Senate expired.
Mark Kirk has been replaced by Mark Kirk,
who's been sworn in. So now we have 42 Republicans, 58 Democrats, counting the two independents who caucus with them. And if all of those Democrats voted for the new START treaty, which is generally anticipated.
Although Ben Nelson of Nebraska.
Good old Ben is.
Okay.
All right. But if we generally assume that they get the 58 Democrats and independents, then you only need 9 Republicans. But, hey, only need 9 Republicans? I mean, we know how big a hurdle it's been to get 1
right.
or 2. throughout this entire two-year period of the 111th Congress. So when you say nine, that sounds enormous. We have Richard Lugar, we know, the senator who is the ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and longtime spokesperson for the Republican Party on foreign policy, especially on issues of nuclear weapon. And an enormous group of Republican luminaries has arisen to say New Start is part of this progression that goes back to Nixon and Reagan. It's not a partisan idea. There's no reason in the world not to vote for this New Start treaty. And that does not seem to have moved very many people. We still are at three Republicans shooting for nine.
One more thing about the Senate. Patty Murray, who just survived a re-election campaign in Washington State, has been named the new chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. She will have the unenviable task.
She gets our condolences.
Exactly. The unenviable task in 2012 when 23 of the 33 Senate seats that are up are Democratic held. She will try to hold on to this Democratic majority.
Well, that's great. They've got 23 and the Republicans just have 10. That means, you know, they've got them outnumbered, right?
Exactly. Well, 2 years from now is a lifetime as this podcast.
In politics?
As this podcast just seems to be a lifetime. But anyway, she has a very unenviable task. It seemed like for the longest time, no Democrat wanted to stand up and take this position.
We are reliably informed that several were asked before Patty Murray.
Absolutely.
Which is not a diss to Patty Murray. I mean, she's obviously not necessarily the most dynamic speaker or the person that you would necessarily want to put out front representing the entire Senate.
She's not a strong fundraiser either.
So her qualification for this particular job may be that
last
she
person
said
standing.
Yes. Well, all right. Not again to cast any asparagus on Patty Murray. She may, in fact, do a fantastic job.
By the way, that's very funny. I like that. But while we're still on Congress, later today, we're taping this podcast on Thursday morning, but later this afternoon, an expected censure vote in the House for Charles Rangel, having served 40 years in the House, reelected overwhelmingly to another term on November 2nd. Yet, he looks like he will be the first member of Congress since 1983 to be censured by his colleagues.
Now, what that means, of course, is that he has to walk down into the well of the House, which is that area right down below the Speaker's dais, and have the charges against him read by the Speaker, and the gavel will be rapped, and he will have to stand there throughout this entire thing being stared at by all his colleagues. It's an extremely uncomfortable procedure, but once the public humiliation is over, what else happens to him?
Nothing. Nothing at all. He retains all his voting privileges. Of course, he's no longer the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee.
But that was already
gone. And
no
Democrat will be chairman of any committee.
But that was gone even before they lost
the
majority.
Well, he was forced out. But I mean, he said, look, I've suffered enough. I was forced to step down as chairman. I've been publicly humiliated. And I still think, though, that had Rangel not fought these charges as long as he did, insisted on his innocence.
It would have been a reprimand.
That's what I think, too.
And it would have gone away.
And a reprimand is just basically a piece of paper.
It's just a letter, you know, from the principal saying that you've been a bad boy, and that's really not a very big deal. In other ethics news, the Justice Department has decided not to further investigate John Ensign, the senator from Nevada. Do you remember this case? Do you remember when this actually came up? You and I were actually young people when this case was first initiated.
Ron, you and I were never young people, let's be honest here. But yes, John Ensign, who had an affair with his top aide's wife and then tried to get that aide a job in the lobbying field. And, of course, that sounds unethical to me.
And then there was a bunch of money that came from John Ensign's family.
Right.
And that was moving around in some funny ways. And it all looked pretty suspicious. And it certainly hasn't done him any good politically. He'll probably get some sort of a Tea Party challenge in 2012.
Well, he did announce a couple of days ago that he intends to run for re-election.
Probably right after he got that letter from Eric Holder telling him he was no longer under investigation.
That does not put him out of reach of the Senate Ethics Committee. And we know how scary that is. I know, trembling. But there may be a Senate ethics investigation on this or something.
Well, we'll watch that space.
One more thing about ethics. Our old friend Tom DeLay was convicted last week.
This was a shocker over the Thanksgiving week. I mean, Tom DeLay, we all knew this case had to be resolved at some point or another, either by a trial or by dismissal of the charges or by some sort of deal. I think we all expected there to be some sort of plea and he would never go to jail. And I still don't think he's going to go to jail.
No, but
wow,
the sentence says that he could face up to 99 years in prison.
He was shocked and he was clearly stunned.
And he will appeal.
I have never seen Tom DeLay so surprised or so wind knocked out of his sails. I mean, even when he had to leave Dancing with the Stars, I mean, it was just nowhere near as much of a shock. And so what happens now? I don't suspect him to go to jail, but it does make it much more difficult for him to get back into politics, I believe. We were thinking a few months ago that this environment, this atmosphere in Texas was going to be perfect for him. He'd be exonerated, and then he would go on to run for certainly Congress again, maybe for the Senate, maybe run against Kay Bailey Hutchison, maybe run for governor, maybe run for president, and then march on to a really big office.
I'll have what she's having. No, but speaking of Dancing with the Stars, there was a very interesting and caustic posting on Politico this week by Joe Scarborough, the former Republican congressman from Florida and
MSNBC host,
who really said that the Republicans have got to realize that it would be a disaster for 2012 were Sarah Palin to be the Republican nominee against President Obama.
Which is not the popular thing to say in the Republican
I think
Party.
It's a widely expressed view, but widely shared, but not so well expressed. Exactly.
And not quite so blatant or boldly. He's going to pay a price for this, I think.
Joe Scarborough?
Yes.
Yes, because everybody loves Sarah Palin on MSNBC.
Yeah, not necessarily on MSNBC, but were he to try to get back into some of the other circles in which he used to travel. Speaking of Republican candidates, many of them won this November.
They did.
They did very well. And yet, the party is not happy, as it was very happy back in 1994, with its national chairman.
Haley Barbour.
Haley Barbour, at the time, was the author of the Rising Tide motto and the Rising Tide strategy, and he really led the way to what was then largely called the Gingrich Revolution. But Haley Barbour had as much to do with nationalizing that election as anyone else. They're not so happy with their current chairman.
They haven't been from almost the time he was elected in January 2009. Yes, the Republicans won control of the House, tremendous gains in the Senate, state legislatures, and yet Michael Steele has always had problems with raising money. He's always been a walking gaffe machine. They think that he's just a liability, not somebody who should be running the party or nominally running the party heading into 2012. And so we had like a little audition this week.
Four candidates. And there are going to be more candidates.
Much more, exactly.
Yeah.
And so my prediction is that Michael Steele does not run.
That he just stepped down.
He will, under tremendous pressure. Knowing that he's under pressure, he may say that, I want to stand up to you guys, but I think he doesn't run.
I think you're right. Hey, one good piece of news. At least we know who won every single contest on November 2nd.
Not true, Ron.
Oh,
not true.
No. Don't tell me that.
We still don't have a winner.
Minnesota?
We still don't have a winner in the Minnesota gubernatorial. We don't know who the new governor will be in Minnesota. The recount. So in Minnesota, they had the recount began for the governor's race there, and Mark Dayton had an 8,770 vote lead.
Approximately.
And yet, bad news for Mark Dayton, 70% of the vote has been counted, and now he's lost about 78 votes total. So it's now...
That's not bad news. You're being ironic.
I am. And basically, it hasn't changed anything.
Did anyone ever think it was going to? I mean, this doesn't seem at all like the Senate race 2 years ago, which was a real question mark. And there was no certainty at all about who was going to win.
And the funny thing about that story...
In fact, even today, there isn't any real certainty.
And the funny thing about that thing is that Norm Coleman has told Joe Miller in Alaska to give up the challenge to Lisa Murkowski.
Oh, that's funny.
Norm Coleman, of all people.
Norm Coleman.
But Norm Coleman was down by like 40 votes or something.
Oh, and he was ahead for a while, too. I mean, look, any election in which you think you're ahead for a while after you think the votes have been counted is when you're going to fight, right?
Right, absolutely.
But Joe Miller is... No. It's very hard. The only thing that could happen in Alaska would be for them to throw out every ballot that didn't spell Lisa Murkowski precisely.
She still wins, though, because she's up by 10,300. He is challenging 8,100 votes of misspellings. That still gives her a 2,000 vote lead.
Well, then what is he thinking?
Well, I don't know, but I think he's just shocked, like Jim DeMint is, the fact that Joe Miller will not be in the 112th Congress.
Well, and Sarah Palin, perhaps.
One House race still undecided, uncalled.
The New York First.
New York First.
Tim Bishop.
He has a 214 or 215. He and Republican Randy Altschuler are deciding whether it's 214 or 215 votes.
I just want the listener to know that you are doing all of this without a single note, which either means that you have a photographic memory or it means you're making all this up.
I don't forget anything, Steve.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
still don't have a winner in the Minnesota gubernatorial. We don't know who the new governor will be in Minnesota. the recount.
How do you still laugh at that?
I don't know. Come on. If I can laugh at asparagus, you can laugh at governor.